The Royal Astronomical Society turns 200 this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. Hoping you and yours are well. We're off to London for a virtual visit with two leaders of the most venerable astronomy organization on our planet. There's much more of our tribute to the RAS online at planetary.org/radio, where we also honor the memory of the late Margaret Burbidge. The great astronomer is remembered by her colleague Brian Keating. Before we get to the downlink headlines, I've got a special invitation to share. I hope you'll join us on Thursday, April 30th at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern, and 2000 hours UTC for the very first What's Up Live. Bruce Betts and I will tell you more during this week's regular What's Up segment, or you can check out planetary.org/live. If you heard my conversation last week with NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine, you were among the first to learn of a new Earth-sized planet in its star's habitable zone. More of this story is at planetary.org/downlink. As is our story about the Mars helicopter that has now been attached to the belly of the Perseverance rover. We've covered developments of this little flying machine here on the show. NASA astronauts Andrew Morgan and Jessica Meyer, as well as Russia's Oleg Skripachka, have returned to terra firma from the International Space Station. The next two ISS visitors are likely to be the first astronauts to catch a ride on a SpaceX Crew Dragon. That historic launch has been tentatively set for May 27th, and you can bet Planetary Radio and the Planetary Society will provide special coverage. The Royal Astronomical Society is celebrating its bicentennial all of this year. Though some of its events have been curtailed by the pandemic, the Society has not backed away from its long and vital role in UK science. Really, the study of astronomy, geophysics, and planetary science throughout the world. I'd have much preferred to visit the RAS at its London headquarters, but my recent virtual visit was lovely. The Society's Deputy Executive Director is astronomer, science educator, and member of the International Astronomical Union, Dr. Robert Massey. His colleague, Dr. Sean Prosser, is the RAS librarian and archivist. Robert Massey, Sean Prosser, thanks very much for joining us on Planetary Radio, and congratulations on this very auspicious 200th anniversary of the Royal Astronomical Society.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
I also want to congratulate you. I saw on your website, which I recommend highly, and we will put a link on this week's show page to the RAS, that the Royal Mail just last month announced Visions of the Universe, a set of 8 postage stamps marking this 200th anniversary of the Society's foundation. Congratulations on that as well.
Yeah, we're very happy with them. The nice thing about the stamps, which for me, I was amazed. I thought this is such a 20th century thing, and you know, there'll be some sort of very focused stamp collectors who are fascinated by them. But to my surprise, they're apparently selling really, really well.
We had to stay quiet about them for so long. It's wonderful to actually see them in the public domain now. You know, it's entirely the Royal Mail's subject. They decided to go with our anniversary, and they commissioned the designers who did a fantastic job.
Take us back to 1820 and the very beginnings, the origin of the Royal Astronomical Society. Robert, how did things get underway?
Well, this is definitely one for Sean to comment on too, but as befits societies and organisations of the time, this one was founded in a pub, and if you've ever been to the UK, then you'll know that pubs are pretty much a central part of our culture, perhaps more than most places in the world. The Freemasons Tavern in what's now Lincoln's Inn Fields, that part of the world where you have all these inns of court, the barristers are registered and so on. And sadly, the pub no longer exists, but the story is of 14 gentlemen, because in those days it would have been just gentlemen, sitting down to dinner to agree the foundation of the Astronomical Society of London, which later on acquired a royal charter and became the RAS. And it stemmed from a desire, I think, to move out of the auspices of the Royal Society, which until around that time was basically doing all the kind of scientific meetings and so on in the UK, obviously in a much, much smaller area of society than we have today. But it is also the oldest astronomical society in the world that's been in continuous existence, almost a full century older, I think, than the AAS. So that's our claim to fame on that.
Sean?
Yes, in doing the fact-checking for this, we did find out that there was an astronomical society set up in Glasgow a few years before, but it did not continue as long. So yes, it is the longest-running astronomical society in the world.
Robert, you mentioned the Royal Society, which had a 160-year head start on the RAS, although I noticed that you now are, at least in terms of the number of members, are about three times as big as the Royal Society. Is there a relationship there, or do you still collaborate between the two?
I mean, it's, you know, I mean, I think, interestingly, Sean had discovered some sort of occasional disputes back in the past, but these days they don't really happen that way. We do collaborate, you know, we go to meetings. We did, for example, very importantly do that quite a long time ago, but a century ago, back in 1919, when the RAS and the Royal Society co-funded an expedition to verify Einstein's theory of general relativity. So certainly by that time, you know, that there wasn't any obvious enmity. And we did that in collaboration with Greenwich. You know, we sent an expeditions to Principe off the coast of West Africa and to Sobral in Brazil to support Einstein's theory. I mean, that's probably actually deserves more questions on it, to be honest, because it's such a fascinating story. But we collaborate not just with the Royal Society, but with all the other scientific societies as well.
Wasn't that Eddington's expedition, and he would become, or maybe already was, one of the long line of your distinguished presidents?
Yeah, and he, you know, was awarded the gold medal and so on, rightly. Absolutely. It's a really brilliant example of an early ish international collaboration in science, because these days in the 21st century and in the second half of the 20th century, you don't tend to have as many things being done by individual nations. Now, I guess the US might be an exception to that, because the US is simply so big in terms of its output. But generally, particularly in Europe and Asia and so on, we tend to be in collaborative systems for doing science. And the nice thing about that expedition was it was being devised during the First World War, long before the Treaty of Versailles was signed as well in November 1919. It was just the idea that you could take a theory from Einstein, a German scientist, a then German scientist, and work out a way to test it. If there's one thing actually that the RAS has done in its history that's contributed to science, I really would cite this, because apart from our existence and hosting things and fostering science and so on, this is really definitively something that transformed our understanding of the universe.
I want to go back to the beginning again. Sean, I see that none other than William Herschel was the first president of the society, though it appeared that maybe he was a little bit reluctant.
He was. He was very advanced in years at the time. He was not the first choice of president. The first president, first person who'd agreed to become president was strongly encouraged to step down by Sir Joseph Banks of the Royal Society, who disapproved of a new scientific society being a new network being set up outside of the auspices of the Royal Society. So in order to sort of proceed with the meetings in a timely manner, William Herschel did agree to be the president, but in name only. He did not want to actually take the chair in meetings. It was his son, John Herschel, who was one of the founding members and who played a leading role in getting the society up and running, and who basically prevailed upon his father to take the titular head. In my role managing the archives and the library of the society, I'd really like to highlight that one of the key parts of the collection are the papers of William and John and Caroline Herschel.
So many distinguished astronomers who have headed the society, in addition to all of those who were members, of course, I saw the name of Fred Hoyle. You even have a Darwin, not Charles, but one of his sons.
Yes, George Darwin, known as the grandfather of geophysics.
You've led me to asking to hear more about your library, which I hear is the envy of many universities and other institutions.
It probably is the envy of many places, apart from perhaps the university, the Edinburgh Observatory. And I'm talking about things like the first edition of Copernicus, which has that really key woodcut showing the sun at the center of the solar system. it has the major works of Johannes Kepler, in which he, in a series of publications, arrives at sketching out what are now known as his three laws of planetary science, in which he comes, you know, he expresses the theory that the reason that Copernicus's theory doesn't quite add up is because the orbits are not perfect circles, they are ellipses. We have the first edition of Newton's Principia Mathematica. As well as all of these major works in the history of science, beautifully illustrated, beautifully bound items. For example, we have an amazing collection of about 50 or 60 early printed books, like incunables, the first books to be printed in Western Europe before 1500, including books like The Sphere by Johannes de Sacrobosco or John of Holyrood, in which he clearly lays out the state of knowledge in the late 15th century, which was that the Earth is clearly spherical. And I like to, this is one of the books that I like to bring out during public events, during open house, to just really highlight to people how long, you know, educated people in universities in the medieval era and before knew that the Earth was round. It's, you know, the idea of the Earth being flat is almost a relative phenomenon, to be honest.
Yes, I know of a few people who could benefit from reading that book today, yes. Sadly.
Really, really good, simple woodcuts. Just a nice picture, for example, of a boat, and there's somebody on the deck, and there's somebody in the crow's nest, and you can see the eye line of the person in the crow's nest seeing the shoreline before the person on the deck. You know, just things like that, which are very, very accessible.
I will note that the RAS began to accept women as members, as fellows, if you will, in 1915, well before women gained the vote here in the United States.
And before they gained the vote, well, even 3 years before they even gained the partial franchise in the UK, actually, as well.
Interesting. You mentioned being involved in space and science policy decisions, as we are at the Planetary Society. How far does that go? I mean, what kinds of policy activities does the RAS take on?
That's very much in my domain. I mean, we've been, as anybody you know follows the UK will know, the UK, even before the COVID epidemic, was paralyzed by another kind of policy issue, which was Brexit. So we've been putting a lot of effort into that and trying to ensure that we remain outward looking and internationally connected, not just obviously with the rest of the world as it always has been, but with our European partners. But we do things like we try to say, well, look, you know, if there's a budget settlement coming up, do not forget fundamental science, because astronomy, nobody, I think, credibly would say, look, you should be spending half your science budget on astronomy, although we'd love that, obviously, but not, we're fairly realistic about these things. But what we would say is that, look, if you want to inspire children to pursue careers in science and technology, then enthusing them about the wider universe is a great way to do it. And to do that, it really is rather helpful if you can point to things that your country is doing. So the things we do really, really well, like, I don't know, membership of the European Southern Observatory, or being the host for the headquarters of the Square Kilometre Array, or being the lead partner on missions like BepiColombo Colombo that's heading to Mercury, or later on this decade, the JUICE mission that will go to Jupiter. Those things really, really matter. And if the public hears about them and they understand that the UK has that talent, or that, you know, there is a small but nonetheless finite possibility that you can actually be one of those specialists, that you could for at least a period of your life get to do science that's that exciting, it's more likely to persuade you to study it.
Your headquarters, Burlington House, is the host to events, both for the Society, of course, but also for outsiders, apparently. It has quite a history itself, doesn't it, Sean?
It does. We moved here in 1874, and the building was built especially for the Royal Astronomical Society. It's part of two wings that were built onto the Royal Academy of Arts premises, which occupy a 17th century mansion that was built by the Earls of Burlington, facing onto the courtyard that has, as on one side, the Royal Academy, but also other learned societies, for example, the Society of Antiquaries, that's a learned society of archaeologists and other people interested in historical studies, the Royal Society of Chemistry, the Geological Society, and the Linnaean Society. And speaking personally, one of the great things about working here is collaborating with my neighbouring collection managers. We like to put together joint events and programmes, drawing on like the similarities as well as the differences in our collections.
I would love to be part of one of those events and perhaps to visit Burlington House someday. But beyond that, if I or anybody else listening to this wanted to become a member of the Royal Astronomical Society, do we have that option?
Well, you do. Generally, we're not a society, say, for everybody in the sense that we welcome an awful lot of people. Well, what we don't want to do fundamentally is take your money if you're not going to get anything out of it, you know, to be idealistic about it. So we are there primarily for the professional research community, but we do have a lot of amateur astronomers who are at what's described as an advanced level. And that, you know, just means that they've got some kind of commitment to advancing the science. They're regular observers, perhaps they're astro imagers or something like that. We have a lot of people who previously studied astronomy, you know, that doesn't have to be at postgraduate level, that can be at undergraduate level as well, who then go on to completely different things. And perhaps I'm making up this example, but you know, if you were working as a wine merchant now, but you'd studied astronomy in the past, we'd probably be okay with that because it's an affinity and it demonstrates that you would get something out of membership. So it's not an onerous application process. You just go to our website and apply, ideally with someone who's already a member to help with your nomination, or you can apply in your own right.
We do have a program called Friends of the Royal Astronomical Society, and that's a growing group of people who I believe it's £40 a year, and there's a whole program of events and activities laid on just for them. And that's a really nice growing community of members.
Before we close, I want to give you a chance to promote something that the RAS is planning for November of this year, when Mars will be close to Earth.
Oh, well, National Astronomy Week. Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things we're involved with. It's not just us. It's UK astronomical societies like the Society of Popular Astronomy, the British Astronomical Association, the local astronomy groups, people in Greenwich and so on, and the research councils who are very interested in this, because there will be at least one or two missions going to Mars this year, which is great. But although the lander, the UK lander's like, you know, now just been delayed, but that's fine, the European Space Agency one. Others will still be there and it'll get there eventually. But the point about Mars is that it's a remarkable object because it captures our imagination. It's one of the places that's most like the Earth in the solar system. Although, yes, I do realize, obviously, you need oxygen. You can't just step out and enjoy it in a science fiction landscape. But there's that tantalizing possibility there might just be life there. The world which is evocative, and yet at the same time, having looked at it with some pretty good telescopes, you realize just how hard it is to see very much as well. So when it comes close to the Earth every 15 or 17 years or so, when it's really good, then it's a great time to encourage people to do that. And for astronomical societies, for amateur astronomers in particular, actually, to help the public see that and get them to get that magical experience of looking at it. So yes, as a public thing later in the year, I'd be delighted to see as many people as possible getting their first look at Mars.
If my travels someday bring me to Burlington House, I want to also make it very clear that you and your colleagues would be very welcome to visit the headquarters of a different society, my society in Pasadena. We don't go back nearly as far as you do. We're just celebrating our 40th anniversary this year. But I think that organizations have a lot in common.
That would be a huge pleasure. I mean, you know, don't underestimate your influence. You're huge. I think you're a very famous organization as well. So it's a pleasure to be talking to you today.
Thank you for that.
I just want to say thank you very much indeed.
Thank you both very much. This has just been a delightful conversation. I hope to repeat it someday in person there at Burlington House.
Excellent. You'd be very welcome there. We'd look forward to seeing you there.
Yeah, that would be great.
Congratulations again on this 200th anniversary of the Royal Astronomical Society. Again, we will put the link to the society, which will be easy to find even if you don't go to the show page, this week's episode page for Planetary Radio. But we have been talking with Robert Massey, Deputy Executive Director of the Royal Astronomical Society, and to Sean Prosser, the librarian and archivist there at the RAS.
Hi, this is Kate from the Planetary Society. How does space spark your creativity? We want to hear from you. Whether you make cosmic art, take photos through a telescope, write haikus about the planets, or invent space games for your family, really any creative activity that's space-related. We invite you to share it with us. You can add your work to our collection by emailing it to us at connect@planetary.org. That's connect@planetary.org. Thanks!
Bill Nye the Planetary Guy here. You've heard Matt deliver highlights from The Downlink, our great space news digest. You told us you want more. Well, you've got it. The Downlink now includes cool space images and fascinating facts about the cosmos that you can share with your friends and family. Best of all, you can have The Downlink delivered to your inbox each week for free. Planetary.org/connect is where to go to learn more and sign up. That's planetary.org/connect for The Downlink.
Time for What's Up on Planetary Radio, and if I could pull it off and didn't mind being in such poor taste, now I would be speaking in a British accent, but they seem to be better at speaking in American accents. People don't realize that you're actually British, and you've been putting on an American accent for us ever since the beginning of this show.
Well, that's true, Matt. It was subtle. I've been in the States so long that it's just really gone away. Okay, this is terrible. This needs to stop now.
Instead, you can tell us about the night sky. Welcome.
I'm comfortable with that. Yeah, we've got in the pre-dawn those three planets. Look in the east in the pre-dawn, and you will see really bright Jupiter, and to its lower left, yellowish Saturn, and to the farther lower left, reddish Mars. And they're kind of separating Jupiter and Saturn, heading away from Mars in the sky. And Mars, watch for it brightening and brightening over the coming months. We've got in the evening sky still Venus, just looking super bright over there in the evening west. On the 26th, the crescent moon will be hanging out near Venus, so that'll be lovely. Comets, they're out there, but they're definitely not naked eye. Comet Atlas broke up, but now we have a possible pinch hitter that'll come in. We'll see. I'll keep you posted. So there may be a naked eye comet. I'm not saying like super bright from a urban area, but there might be one in mid to late May still. Probably not Comet Atlas. Ah, the dogs hate that.
I'm really getting angry with the Oort cloud. I mean, is it true? Millions and millions of them out there? How come we don't get more? Come on, cloud, deliver.
Sentences I never thought I would hear. I'm really getting angry with the Oort cloud. Be careful what you ask for.
Okay, never mind.
All right, we move on to this week in space history. Big week in space history. 30th anniversary of the deployment of the Hubble Space Telescope. That thing's still just cranking. Mm. I mean, obviously, it had some servicing missions along the way. I think it's done neat stuff. It's done something. It's called the Hubble Space Telescope.
Random space fact!
Wow.
We'll be coming back to X-15 pilots, but I thought I'd note 8 X-15 pilots went above the U.S. Air Force definition of space, 50 miles. One, Joe Walker on two flights went above the FAI definition of space at 100 kilometers. That made, going with the FAI definition, Joe Walker the 13th person to have reached space.
Oh, because he did that well into the Soviet and American space programs with capsules.
Yep, exactly.
Huh. We did have a bunch of people who talked about, what about all those pilots who made it above 50 miles, that Air Force definition, but only Walker, who went past, you said FAI, but that's the Kármán line, right? 100 km or 62 miles?
It is indeed. It's the general international definition from the Fédération Aéronautique Internationale. I don't know how to speak French. I apologize.
First we mangle English, or at least British, yeah. And now...
What else can we mangle? There's no real magic as to where space starts. It's a gradual transition, but there is some physics as to why you might pick rounded off to 100 kilometers, but essentially it's a fairly arbitrary definition. So let's get on to the trivia contest. I asked you which X-15 pilots later flew on NASA spacecraft missions.
And it's that word later that I think is very important because, I mean, there were people who just thought that this was a little bit too ambiguous. Talking about you, Kay Gilbert. But later, after the X-15, we have a winner from a part of this planet that we have never had a winner from before, at least in my memory, Pavel Kumesha. lives in Belarus. There are only two of them, Neil Armstrong, Gemini 8 and Apollo 11, and Joe Engel, STS-2 and STS-51I. Is that an I or a 1? I'm not actually sure. He did also mention that accomplishment by Joseph Walker, who crossed the FAI, the Kármán line. All of this, Pavel, that's enough to make you this week's winner. Congratulations. You, if you choose to have it. We probably don't speak what is spoken locally there.
But we could mangle it, I'm sure.
Yeah, we have a good track record there. We will be happy to record a message for you, Pavel, of any reasonable length, and we'll be in touch with you about that. What do you got for next time?
It's two-part. I think you'll like it. First part, straightforward. What is the name of the launch spacesuit used for launch and landing in the Soyuz spacecraft? And what does it have to do with Japanese sample return missions and SpaceX rockets? Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
Wow. I don't even know the first part and the second part. My goodness. We really ought to come up with something special for this, much more special than our voices on your voicemail system. Tell you what, I mean, we'll figure out some way to get you something special like a rubber asteroid, okay? It may take a while, but we'll get it to you. You have until the 29th, that'd be Wednesday, April 29th at 8 a.m. Pacific time to get us this answer and win yourself our voices and a mystery prize that will probably include a rubber asteroid. Listen, there is one other thing we have to mention. We brought it up sort of nebulously last week. Now we can be a little bit more firm. On Thursday, April 30th at 1 p.m. Pacific time, that's 4 p.m. Eastern and 2000 hours UTC, you and I will be live. I'm not talking Planetary Radio Live here, which is not truly live. We're talking What's Up Live. And we hope that all of you will join us because you'll get to participate. To learn more and to watch it, for that matter, you can go to planetary.org/live. Planetary.org/live. Thursday the 30th. Be there.
Be there. You'll see our beautiful faces as well as hear our bad accents.
Anyway, it's kind of your show because it is What's Up. But are you going to have random space facts and maybe some trivia questions for people?
We will indeed. We'll also, talk about the night sky because we can. And we will also take questions from the world, which is a little terrifying.
This is how it's going to start. We're the first. And hopefully we won't ruin it for our colleagues.
But if we do, we'll go out in a blaze of glory.
Yeah, we may find ourselves above the von Kármán line. We're done. Get us out of here.
Aye, Matt. We should think about what your favorite accent is to mess up. That'd be great. Go out there, look up in the night sky and think about the accent you would mangle. Thank you and good night.
Aye, laddie. That's it. I'm done. And he's done, too. That's Bruce Betts. He's the chief scientist of the Planetary Society, who joins us every week for What's Up and for What's Up Live on Thursday, April 30th. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its Anglophilic members. Mark Hilverde is our associate producer. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which is arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. Be safe, everyone. Ad Astra.